obviously this episode we're going to be talking about Batman, but when I texted you, I got the sense that you were kind of afraid of what I was going to say or think about this movie. And I'm curious why that is. Like,
well, because, you know, lately, the past couple of like big blockbuster movies, we've been a little bit more divergent. So,
okay.
I don't know. I'm coming into this feeling pretty positive about this movie. So if the recent past is any indication, you might be a lot more negative than I would hope, because I don't know. This one is a bit of a, I'm excited about this one. So, but we'll get into it. That was the genesis of my kind of hesitancy there.
Do you fear me?
I fear your contrarian nature.
I don't know. I think, am I that contrarian? I don't think so. I think you're more contrarian than me sometimes.
Okay. Well, you know, we trade blows, I guess, but you may be contrarian more often than I am. But not like to an extreme degree. You're not like some Armand White type guy who just like hates on movies for the sake of being against the grain.
Yeah, true. I think it's because I probably stay away from the dark corners of social media. Unlike you, I don't know where you find these things like the Nolan hate train.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Well, yeah, that was every so often you know, film Twitter will kind of lift a tweet into my timeline. Usually through quote tweets, because it's not like I follow any of these people who have these terrible takes. But yeah, there's been people in the aftermath of the Batman coming out who have been, I don't know, taking this strange revisionist view of the Nolan Batman films, where they are essentially kind of saying, oh, these things were too realistic, and they're not the Batman that we really deserve or need, because, you know, there's not enough supernaturalness to them, or Nolan's vision of Gotham is just Chicago and stuff like that. And I'm like, you're kind of like, these people are kind of saying the point out loud, you know? The whole idea of the Nolan Batmans was to be realistic, to kind of show like, all right, if you strip Batman down to his like core nature, and you want to see like, how would a realistic Batman actually look? I guess Nolan's would be it. More so than the Batman, certainly.
I thought we liked the realistic Batman, because otherwise we'd have Batman and Robin all over again.
Yeah, that was, you know, the whole idea of the Nolan Batmans was kind of response to how cartoony it got with Joel Schumacher, which is its own thing. Like, I'm not, you know, I understand people who also like the cartoony Batman. There's a Batman for everybody out there. But yeah, the whole point is to see different visions of the character. So I don't know. There were people who were kind of making it sound like, it's like, I never liked it anyway. It was kind of the tone.
I mean, I have to say, though, like, the bar is set really high for Batman films. So, I mean, yeah. Do you want to just get into it then?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Welcome to the Extra Buttery Podcast. It's a show about movies, TV, anything with a story and actors on a screen, really. Join Jason Chan and Robert Snow's free-flowing conversation with deep dives into characters and plot with the occasional salty opinion. So get your popcorn. I got mine right here. Let's start the show!
Welcome to the 106th episode of the Extra Buttery Podcast. My name is Jason Chen, and I'll be your host with my co-host Robert Snow.
Hey, how's it going?
And as alluded to in the intro, we're dedicating this entire episode to the Batman film. Rob and I are huge fans of Batman. Ever since we were kids, I bet, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, probably my introduction to the character would have been a combination of my mom's love of the Adam West series from the 60s, plus the original Bruce Timm Batman the Animated Series in the 90s, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible. All right, so before we get into it, a quick overview, even though I'm sure everyone knows all the basic details about this film. The Batman is the newest Batman film, directed by Matt Reeves, who did the Planet of the Apes series, and it stars Robert Pattinson in the titular role as Bruce Wayne Batman, Zoe Kravitz as Selina Kyle Catwoman, Paul Dano as the villain, the Riddler, Jeffrey Wright is, at this point, Lieutenant Gordon, not the commissioner of the police force yet, and Andy Serkis as Alfred, and Colin Farrell rounding out the crew as a mobster known as the Penguin.
The Riddler is asking for you.
The killer left this for the Batman. Why is he writing to you?
You came. I've been trying to reach you.
Riddler's latest. It's all about the Waynes. If we don't stand up, no one will.
You got a lot of cats.
I have a thing about strays.
This is not related at all to the Batman or the Zack Snyder universe Batmans. This is definitely a reboot, but we're all familiar with the story now. Bruce Wayne, billionaire orphan, has a ton of psychological issues, probably should be committed to a mental asylum at some point, dresses up as a bat in the night, and beats up criminals as a vigilante. Difference between Batman and all the other superheroes we get is, of course, that his superpower is that he's insanely rich.
Mm-hmm.
He does not shoot laser from his eyes.
No.
He does not fly. He does not have super strength. He does not have healing powers. He does not have any of that. So in this film, again, we're thrust into the beginning years of the Batman. This is technically year two of the Batman. So we skip the origin story. We skip the parents' death. And we're thrown into this dark, cynical world where the Batman is still really trying to figure out who he is.
And I gotta say, I mean, it's exactly the kind of Batman story that I wanted, because we've seen the year one stuff from Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. We've seen him, you know, and then the Nolan films depicted like middle career, end career Batman, albeit with like big time jumps in between. So it's nice to kind of get something that's neither of those things, that is, you know, like you said, he's finding his feet. His costume isn't, you know, fully developed. There are sort of a few more DIY parts to it. The Batmobile isn't even fully up and running when the movie starts. And he actually spends most of his time zipping around Gotham, not even in costume, just on his motorcycle with a standard motorcycle helmet and kind of stealth clothes, you know?
Yeah. And so to give you a better sense of like the emotional sort of tone of the movie, it is heavily influenced by Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, as you've seen all in the trailers. Robert Pattinson even has the Kurt Cobain haircut,
yeah,
where he's got the long bangs and like half his face is hidden all the time. It's dark. It's gritty. It's very... not poorly lit, but it's much darker, I think, in terms of the cinematography compared to other Batman films.
Yeah.
They're all varying shades of red, black, and orange. And even the Riddler, I think, we're used to this like fluorescent green costume.
Yeah.
And he's very much muted in this. It's very much more of an army green.
Yes.
Like a fatigue green in this one. And so it's very much Batman in more of its raw form. If there was a subtitle to this film, I would say it's The Batman, World's Greatest Detective. And I think that's where I want to start, is because right off the get-go, Batman we see as a sort of like a detective. Like he's trying to solve this murder that happens at the beginning of the movie.
It's actually the mayor of Gotham himself. So... you know, it's kind of a big deal. And yeah, we see Gordon call him in to attend the crime scene. And it's kind of cool to see how the cops are both like terrified of him, but also very nervous to trust him. And they're literally asking Gordon, like, well, what about the chain of evidence on this thing? You know, I mean, how can we let this guy touch, you know, rifle through the stuff in the crime scene?
Yeah. So right off the bat, this is a murder thriller.
Yep.
There are elements of horror in it, which I do appreciate. And I think, Rob, maybe to your relief, I really, really like this film too.
Yes. Yes. This is good. Okay.
We'll talk about like the Batman films like in general, all the live action ones. And we'll do a little fun exercise where we kind of rank them, because I think that's where we might differ a little bit.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But... holy hell, I did not expect something of this caliber. I definitely thought it'd be more action-oriented, especially in certain parts, especially since you have so many villains, mm-hmm. especially with the Riddler coming off as so much more of a menacing physical threat because, you know, he's blowing people up and he's killing people. But we don't really get that. It's a very moody film. And I think it's very different from all the other Batman films, just from that detective perspective and just the emotional tone as well.
Yeah. And it might be like, it might be a bit cliche to say, but it does, the way it's lit and the way the tone is set does remind me a lot of the comics specifically.
Yeah, you know, for sure. There's a lot of inspiration from it. You can tell from the plot too.
Yeah, there's a strong visual style. Very, you know, it's stylistic. You know, in a way that, you know, no, Christopher Nolan's films have their own style. But I remember when, say, The Dark Knight came out, a lot of people were making fun of like, oh, superhero movies are gritty now. And I'm like, well, you know, did they really mean gritty or did they mean realistic? You know. Or as close to reality as you can get with a guy dressing up as a bat and fighting crime, you know. So like Nolan's films are more in that like realism side of things. But I would say this is by far the grittiest live action Batman that we've seen.
It definitely feels more gothic.
Yes. And like, and you see that in like the way Gotham is rendered too, like the production design. It's like a lot of wrought iron and mm-hmm. you know, big shadowy corners and old school architecture mm-hmm. and they make really good use of that in the opening scenes where they literally show, you know, the bad guys in Gotham committing various crimes and looking around and like being convinced that that Batman is in every shadowy corner. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. does so much to evoke, you know, how far Pattinson's Batman has come in his 2-year project. And also just making you as the viewer kind of be like, okay, all right, I see the effect that this character is having in this world.
I think, you know? Matt Reeves is one of the best storytellers out there.
Yeah.
I think yeah. what he did with Planet of the Apes franchise was fantastic, and I love the direction he went in on this one.
Yes.
And to your point, you mentioned that Christopher Nolan's Batman universe looks very much like Chicago, and I totally get it, and I do feel the same way.
Yeah.
But in this film, I don't think they make any sort of effort to really hide that this city is New York. Like, instead of Madison Square Garden, it's Gotham Square Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, architectural landmarks that you know right away are, like, reminiscent of like Times Square or the Flatiron Building or the Empire State
yeah,
Building.
Yeah, but it's not like it's not the New York of today necessarily. It feels no, more like New no, York no. of the 70s and 80s. And but it's very clear that this is a Gotham that may have the architecture of that period, mm-hmm. but it's still set in the modern era because people are using smartphones and, you know, Batman has access to all of the usual high tech stuff that we would expect him to, including those super cool video recording contact lenses that he uses to ensure that he lays eyes mm-hmm. on in a crime scene is captured for his review in the Batcave later.
I should preface this by saying that like we're probably going to enter into like spoiler territory at some point.
Yep. Yeah.
So this is your fair warning that from now on, there might be things that we might want to talk about that you might not want to hear if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah. We're at the point now where like you can kind of tell that both of us are pretty stoked about this yeah. movie. So if that's all you need to decide to go out and see it, then
yeah.
pause, go book a ticket and, you know, pick us up after you get back.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just get into it. So the first scene is the mayor getting killed.
Yep.
I think right off the bat, that had me hooked because that's not something we see in a lot of Batman films, right?
So at first, I was convinced that the perspective that we were taking in that opening shot was actually Batman himself.
Yeah, exactly.
And then for a while, I thought, wait a second, no, it's not. And then I thought maybe we were seeing the flashback, the classic Batman movie flashback to the Waynes being killed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it became clear that there wasn't that either because... you know, once we get inside the house, we see, you know, that it's a contemporary thing. And the guy's watching political coverage, like a wrap up of the mayoral debate that he had just completed.
And the murder itself was brutal. I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
Like it very much was like a sort of shock to the senses because the mayor gets basically bludgeoned to death.
Yeah.
And you hear every bit of like the crunch and the thump.
Yeah.
And the whole duct tape thing. And then the whole Batman entrance, I thought, was really well done. What I really liked, though, is that they didn't bother to, like, really dig into the relationship between him and Gordon, it's just established that they know each other and that there's a level of trust between them.
Yep.
But I do find that there's still a lot of exposition in this movie. I read somewhere, or my friend told me, that there is another version out there that's around 20 minutes shorter, but it didn't test very well with the focus groups.
Oh.
But I also wonder, you know, if it's slow because this Batman that we see from Robert Pattinson takes forever to walk across the room.
Well, maybe he's being extra slow so that those video recording contacts actually get the best material.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's kind of interesting that we kind of see the bat suit in pretty good light from the beginning. What did you think of it?
I like the suit. I mean, you know, obviously there's a limited, production designers are probably limited a little bit because the bat suit always has to have several key things. You know, you need the cowl, mm-hmm. you need the utility belt, you need some sort of like armor over the chest, you know. There were some theories out there, but when the first little teaser images of the suit were posted online, that possibly the metal that you see inside the bat symbol was actually the parts of the gun that killed his parents. Mm-hmm. And people were theorizing, oh, that, like, what a kind of a cool thing for him to do. Like, he's taking that ultimate inspiration and putting that right in the chest of his suit. But it turns out to be just the Batarang, I think, or several Batarangs.
Yeah. So, okay, what's up with that? Like, I know he detaches it and he kind of uses it as a knife.
Yeah.
And the Batarang is different in that, like, he doesn't throw it and it's not, like, remote controlled, or it doesn't, back to him and he catches it in midair.
Yeah.
It's
he hasn't invented those yet. Maybe that's later on.
Yeah, that's true. The one thing that kind of made me laugh a little, though, is that he must have taken, like, what, 40 gunshots straight to the chest?
Oh, and it does nothing. That, there were people.
He takes like a buckshot shotgun to the chest and it like does nothing.
I mean, the shotgun blast does knock him on his ass for a while, like in the way that it should. It doesn't like injure him, but it like, you know, it knocks the breath out of him.
Yeah, right.
But there are definitely like when he's going into the Iceberg Lounge near the end of the film to take Carmine Falcone into custody, there are goons that were just like opening up at his chest with, you know,
machine guns.
Yeah. And it doesn't stop him for a second, which I guess is like, you know, we've always expected Batman to be pretty good at facing off against those kind of guys. So you can chalk it up to stormtrooper aim. These guys never really aim at the very visible target of his face. You know?
Yeah, I know. Right. The only exposed part of his body, and they don't aim for it at all. I mean, yeah, that's just hilarious.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I will have to say, though, that scene in the, I think it's the tunnels that he's going through too, right? Like the underground in the Iceberg Lounge. I thought that was better than the Dark Knight Rises Catwoman and Batman going through the tunnels to go see Bane.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, it was more moodily lit. You know, it was just illuminated by the muzzle flash on the guns, and the stuff leading up to the Bane fight in Dark Knight Rises felt a little bit kind of like, oh, a goon, whap, another goon, whap. You know, it's just it felt a little bit too easy.
Yeah. So the other thing I want to mention is too, like, I think Christopher Nolan has a good like feel for how to create a special effect, especially through practical means.
Yep.
But I think in terms of like making it make sense on the screen, I think this movie's action sequences were much better. Like the choreography and the whole like movement, everything seemed to have depth and emotion to it.
I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I do know that there are certain shots from like Batman Begins and The Dark Knight that have a few weird like continuity errors in them. Like,
oh, for sure.
Especially like
The Dark Knight Rises is the worst for this one, I think.
Yeah, especially like some of the driving like chase scenes. There are weird kind of moments.
Cuts
that don't make a lot of sense and can actually really throw you off in terms of like characters that shouldn't be where they are, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. But I found that in this one too, though, when he was in the penguin chase.
Yeah, I was never confused. I know there's still, to this day, there are a few sequences that still throw me off about the way Nolan edited some of those chase scenes. But the action scenes are fewer and far between compared to the Nolan films.
Yeah.
So they get their money's worth out of the ones they have. I like the kind of more brutal fighting style that Pattinson chose to go with, where it's like it really feels like he's hammering guys until they're not gonna get up anymore.
Yeah, it, you know, actually feels like being Batman is therapy for him.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
because as I think it's shown in the trailer, where he introduces himself not as Batman but as I Am Vengeance.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like the linchpin of his character arc throughout the film. And we, as he's narrating his diary, which he keeps as like the Gotham City project, mm-hmm. we kind of learn his motivations and learn how he gets to become who he is by the end of the film. And I thought that was really fantastic.
Yeah.
But he doesn't get to do that without the help of Catwoman, Zoe Kravitz. So this is a very different Catwoman. We've had three. I would count Halle Berry as not a Catwoman because that's just it was horrible.
Yeah.
But we had Michelle Pfeiffer, Anne Hathaway, and now Zoe Kravitz. And I'm not counting the old live action Catwoman as well, who's I think very different.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah.
Who played her? Was it Meriwether?
I can't remember.
Something Meriwether. I can't remember. But she was good. But anyway, the Zoe Kravitz is a very different Catwoman. And I really, really liked her. And she was in the movie a lot more than I thought she would.
Yeah. Well, they. I remember some of the early marketing, maybe a couple months ago, was pitching this movie as like the Bat and the Cat team mm-hmm. up to do this thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't end up being quite like a team up movie in that sense, because you know she does disappear for big chunks of the movie, but yeah, she's definitely more involved. They work really hard on the relationship between the two of them,
mm-hmm.
and whereas the Michelle Pfeiffer version was obviously like totally nutty and kind of like convinced that she was a cat or cat, and then the Anne Hathaway one was very much not that and was mostly just like a jewel thief who had a thing for skin tight cat suits. And
I know. Okay, so the way you described it, I think, shows Christopher Nolan's faults in writing female characters.
If you
really think about Catwoman in The Dark Knight Rises, what does she really do? She rides the bike for a while. She shoots a couple guys, and that's kind of it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she doesn't really move the plot along like Catwoman does in this one.
No.
Because her backstory is vital to the whole murder mystery.
Oh, yeah, because this Catwoman is best friends with, roommates even, with one of the main murder victims who's like central mm-hmm. to figuring out where the Riddler is. Because ultimately that is what mm-hmm. Batman is trying to do. He sees that the Riddler is leaving his classic, you know, puzzles around the city, mm-hmm. each with like a letter to Batman attached mm-hmm. to them. And he says, I'm going to keep killing until you figure out where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And then that ties in with this multi-generational corruption scheme that is goes back through the history of Gotham and obviously connected to the Waynes. And, you know, so you get this sense that like this isn't just a Gotham City that was just sort of poof. Here it is. It, you know, you get a sense of the history, obviously.
Yeah, she's very much her own character, which I totally appreciate in this one. And it's not like she's this in relation to Batman's this. She's really like a fully fleshed character on her own with their own motivations and everything.
Yeah.
And the other villain in this movie, minor villain, is the Penguin. And I love Colin Farrell. And when he said like, oh, like being in that makeup was really liberating, like people didn't recognize me. I mean, if you had not told me that was Colin Farrell, and we saw the production photos too, like,
yeah,
he really does not look like Colin Farrell, and he did such a good job.
Oh yeah, it's exactly the type of Penguin that I like, where, you know, people might like the Danny DeVito one because he was weird and creepy and horror-esque, but you know, ultimately the most common and probably most plausible version of the Penguin is just a gangster who happens to have a beaky nose, you know? And
yeah. There's certain shots where like the shadows really accentuate his nose, and it actually looks like a beak from certain angles.
Yeah, because clearly like this version of the Penguin has gotten to a fight at some point. Someone scarred him up, and they have these big slashes near his nose, which accentuate that a little bit too. But yeah, he's just the proprietor of the Iceberg Lounge, and of course he's tied in with the Falcones and the Maronis and all of those people. So yeah, that's always been, he's always been a better villain when he's just been one of the more cartoonish of the gangsters out there, and not, you know, someone on the tier of the Joker or the Riddler or Mr. Freeze, whoever.
I don't think he even kills anybody in this film, but he definitely feels threatening as a character.
He's very well connected, but he's got this physical presence too.
Yeah. Because in all the other versions, he's just this round tubby dude with a machine gun umbrella.
Yeah.
And it's like, how does this guy beat Batman in a fist fight? There's no chance.
Yeah.
But in this one, he actually feels threatening on like an intellectual level as well.
Yeah.
And I love some of like the little inside jokes. There's this part where he gets tied up by Gordon and Batman and his feet are tied up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as they leave to go solve the mystery, he kind of waddles towards them.
Exactly.
I thought that was a really nice nod to the Penguin. There's a lot of like little Easter eggs in there. That I really appreciate, because unless you're like a real Batman geek, you don't really notice them. But they also just kind of fit within the movie.
And the Riddler was good on that score, too. I mean, he, you know, like you were saying, he's definitely a little bit more muted, a lot more muted compared to, say, like Jim Carrey's version in Batman Forever. But, you know, he's still got like the color scheme. He's got all of like the puzzles are just as intricate and creepy as they always were in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
But you also get that sense of him, like the Riddler is very much a villain who is like a mind controller type guy, you know, where it's not just about leaving creepy things that blow up. It's about getting other people to do his bidding because he himself is not a huge physical threat. And that's exactly what happens here. And then they tie it in with like stuff to do with, you know, creepy cults on social media. You know, it's updated for a more modern audience. And you see him as this like almost Twitch streamer, YouTuber with like a small following of very hyper passionate fans who are creepy themselves.
Thank you to my followers.
Exactly. Yeah. That was a good little touch. You know, if you spend any time following online creators, you know, that those things will feel very familiar, but still very creepy, you know. And when Paul Dano is allowed to finally like be fully on camera doing the classic supervillain monologue thing, it doesn't really read as like a, you know, other actors or other filmmakers might have made that feel a little bit like self-parody, but when Paul Dano's doing it in that scene in Arkham, you really feel the menace and the creepiness behind it, because he's very believable in how demented he is and how much he believes that he and Batman were actually like, you know, on the same side. Mm-hmm. And when that idea is challenged, he totally freaks out, and it's very disturbing.
I've never seen another actor who seems more disturbing when he smiles than when he doesn't.
Yeah, that's a good way. Yeah.
And that's Paul Dano in a nutshell, right? Like every time he smiles, there's a certain like creepiness to him. Almost Barry Keoghan-esque, but a little more unhinged. And we'll get to Barry Keoghan in a second.
Oh, we will.
We'll get to him in a second. Did you find, though, Paul Dano seemed a little... The way he spoke seemed a little over the top.
Maybe. I mean, I guess if I had to guess, maybe he was going for a bit of like autism spectrum type stuff.
Right.
Okay. And you could argue one way or the other whether that was necessary or appropriate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it definitely evoked somebody who had been in their own head a little bit too long and had not really sought any kind of like help or exterior influences or anything like that.
Certainly someone who's never been sort of accepted by society,
yeah,
and like learned the society's norms and all that kind of stuff.
Very
much an outcast. But I also think he was a perfect foil in what would be a mystery story, because he's leaving all these clues, and it's not like Batman in the Dark Knight, like being a detective where he like fires a gun at a brick and then reconstructs a bullet fragment to get a thumbprint.
Yeah.
Like where that's like, it's so far fetched. This one where I think Batman really has to rely on his intellect. And there are certain roadblocks in his way. Like not only Riddler is the person he's fighting against, at certain parts, Catwoman refuses to cooperate.
Yep.
He uncovers like a dark family secret from Alfred that he never knew, that kind of turns his world upside down.
Yep.
Speaking of Alfred, he's in it a lot less than I thought, because in all the other films, Alfred is a bit of a mentor, but in this one, I don't get that sense.
I get the sense that they kind of approached it in the sense of like similar in how we don't see him learning to be Batman. It's kind of like taken for granted that he's had a lot of training. He's been taught how to fight. He's been taught how to use detective skills. Mm-hmm. They kind of, you know, this is where I think they respect the audience's intelligence and familiarity with the stuff. So Alfred does say, oh, I've trained you how to fight, you know, and he mentions being in MI6 and working for the Secret Service in England and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they just they kind of push that stuff to the background, and who knows, maybe we'll get more of Alfred in the next film.
Because there are a lot of characters they have to juggle in this film.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like at certain parts, I do feel the plot is convoluted, and honestly, the 3 hour thing, it's a bit long.
But I mean, it's 3 hours, and I didn't feel the length in the way that I have with other super long superhero movies.
Yeah, fair enough. Me too.
So,
because I think the mystery is compelling enough, right? Like,
yeah,
they're really good at leaving you crumbs at like certain moments to keep you kind of guessing and moving along.
It's so tied up with like it encourages you to get to know this version of Gotham, I think, which is probably the most interesting part. I mean, I think historically, Batman, because of his great rogues gallery, you get this sense of like, okay, this is a city that is just absolutely infested with all of these different levels of crime. You've got people who are cartoonish like the Joker. You've got people who are a few rungs below him like Riddler. Mm-hmm. You've got people who are, you know, more like the Penguin, and they're just like tuned up gangsters. And then you've just got like the lowest level crime, and you've got like corruption too within the police force. So it's it really creates this whole like canvas of all of the things that Batman has to deal with, and all, you know, how he so it encourages you to kind of feel like, okay, this really is a challenge for this one guy to tackle, and it's not just a matter of like a guy flying around with a cape and punching up a few goons and leaving them for the cops on the you know, the steps of the police station, so I feel like it earns its length in that way, you know. And and like you said, it's a mystery, so you want to know what the answer is as much as Batman does.
Yeah. And one of my favorite scenes is when Batman gets knocked out and gets taken to the police station.
Yeah.
And he escapes. And as he escapes, there's like the whole police force is running after him.
Yeah.
And then he runs to the top of the building. And then before he jumps off, as he always does, he kind of does like a double take.
Yes.
Because he's like, whoa.
Yeah, it's tall.
And then he jumps off and flies off in his like glider suit or whatever. And
yeah,
I thought that was really, really cool to see, just like this Batman again. We love like superheroes who make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
So he's very much early in his career. And I thought that scene was really funny where he'll crash land and he'll get up, look around, see if anyone's watching, and then just kind of stumble
over. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, yeah, because that really reinforces the idea of like he's new to this job, you know, and he's not going to have the perfect solution for every problem that he faces. And yeah, that helps the audience kind of get on his side.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much, you know, it's very much in line with the comics, too, because there are frequently panels in comics where Batman's interior monologue is going and he'll make commentary about, you know, how he could have done something better or how he made a mistake with something or other.
There's a big sequence in like the stadium where like the whole last fight is staged.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it was not satisfying, because in every other film, if you think about it, we've always had like a final showdown between Batman and the villain.
Yeah.
And in this film, we've got like the plexiglass scene where it's kind of like reminiscent of the Joker Batman interrogation scene.
Yes.
And so in this one, it's Batman basically beating up a bunch of thugs in the final sort of act. How did you react to that, and how did you like that sort of development?
It caught me a bit by surprise. I know some people online have said that they don't like the third act for that reason, because they...
Yeah.
But I think that's playing into people's expectations about how superhero movies should be structured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's okay to have a conclusion like this where it's a little bit, you know, the actual main villain has been arrested, and but yet his plan has been sufficiently set in motion that, you know, Batman doesn't have to deal with actually knocking Riddler's lights out. He has to deal with the consequences. And I think it's a conclusion that kind of fits the overall snarly, corruption laced mystery story at the center of the film. You know, there are parts of that corruption scandal that Batman can't fix. And so here he is facing this kind of disaster where there's water pouring in from all sides because of the bombs that the Riddler set off. And he's got these guys inside the main refuge who are sniping at, you know, other figures in the city's political elite. And it's a real challenge for one guy to handle in the same way that the corruption stuff was. And I don't know. It's, yeah, it is missing that big, like, Rock'em Sock'em Knockout stuff, but
I
thought it was it fit the movie, it fit the story that the movie was trying to tell. But did were you hoping for a little bit more of a classic showdown style climax?
Yeah, and I also understand that this movie was kind of setting it up for the two other films in this whole like universe that they're gonna build out.
Yeah,
and I was always very curious about how they made Riddler physically threatening. Because he's a nerd who likes riddles.
Yeah.
Like, in a fist fight, he has no chance.
Yeah.
So, the idea of Batman, you know, beating up a bunch of thugs was interesting to me to see. Because it's just fun to see Batman take on a whole bunch of guys at once. But I do find it just felt a little dissatisfying. Because, again, Batman takes, like, 30 gunshots to the chest. Yeah. And nothing happens.
Yeah.
This Batman, too, has, like, a shortage of cool gadgets, which I kind of appreciate. Mm. But I think it would have been nice to see him, you know, be a little more inventive, a little more creative in taking out the thugs rather than just, you know, like, jumping all over the place and punching this
and
that.
Yeah,
but I feel like that's really minor.
Yeah. I like I said, I'm kind of fine with it. It's it did remind me, and somebody that I follow on Twitter made a connection to the comic arc Hush.
Yes.
Which was a pretty popular one from, I guess, the early 2000s, I think it started, which concludes with Riddler being unmasked as the ultimate puppet master behind all sorts of supervillains breaking free of Arkham and causing their own trouble. So Batman has to deal with all of these individual situations. He has to go tackle Killer Croc, and he's got to figure out what Poison Ivy's up to, and you know, XYZ. And then finally he traces it all back to Riddler, and Riddler's been in Arkham the whole time. And so Batman just has this showdown with Riddler in Arkham, very similar to what we see in this movie.
Well, I was going to say very similar to Blofeld in No Time to Die, where he somehow runs the whole operation from his prison
cell. I'm the architect of all your pain or whatever.
Yeah. But it's really interesting that you kind of mentioned Thomas Elliot, because there's three kind of things I want to touch on, because this movie is obviously going to develop more storylines as we go on.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Thomas Elliot. One of the biggest retcons for me, it does follow like certain versions of Batman, is that his personal family history, his parents, are not shown to be exemplary citizens of Gotham.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was a very interesting development. I did feel like maybe he kind of got over it a little too quickly.
Yeah.
But did you have any thoughts about that? Because they did talk about Thomas Elliot, and they kind of hinted towards Hush. I don't know if that's like a hint for the future villain or just like an Easter egg.
Oh, did they actually call out Thomas Elliot in the movie?
So it's in one of those like news archived newspaper reels.
Oh.
You see Thomas Elliot's name. And then there is like Hush somewhere written on there. I don't know if it's the same reel or not, but it's in there.
Okay, interesting.
So we're going to go have to watch this movie again anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't catch that at all. And I'm one of the people who actually kind of liked Hush. It has its critics, but
I loved Hush. Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, I see what you mean, though, about the Waynes being revealed to be less than stellar or citizens. You know, they have this public face where they're like, you know, launching this $1 billion reconstruction fund to save Gotham, but it's actually becomes this cesspool of corruption. It's helpful on a character level for him to kind of have his own personal assumptions about his parents challenged. Because, you know, he goes into the Gotham Project because he sees his parents as being morally perfect and an example of like people who had the right idea for Gotham but were cut down by the crime.
Yes, agreed. You know,
festering in the streets or whatever. And to have that kind of assumption challenged is kind of cool, you know. And you have a point, though, that in the movie's version of it, he does get over it pretty quickly. You know, once that scene with Alfred in the hospital rolls out, it's like, okay, I've accepted that my parents are you know, not as morally perfect as I thought. Well, I'll just, you know, learn to live with this, you know.
But it also, I think, more importantly, like, brings him out from underneath his dad's shadow.
It gives him closure.
Yeah, closure. And even though they made a point of saying, like, we actually will probably never know who killed their parents. Like, it's just something that happened and you just have to live with it. I really like that aspect of it because there's too many times in the past where like they like retcon his parents' killers as being the Joker or Victor Zsasz or whatever, and it just kind of gets too complicated and also a little too convenient sometimes. So I like the ambiguity because this Batman deals a lot with ambiguity.
Yeah, exactly. It's Batman is at his best when he's being presented as like the only solution to a totally broken system, you know. Where the GCPD has, you know, good cops like Jim Gordon, but they also it also has a lot of bad cops. And, you know, if you had a police system that was working perfectly, you wouldn't need a guy going around dressed as a bat beating people up, right? So, you need that ambiguity in a Batman movie to kind of make you question, is what the cops are doing correct? Is what Bruce Wayne is doing correct? You know, you have to, because he obviously has some very brutal methods in this, and he beats down criminals probably longer than he needs to, you know, before, after he's taken them out of commission. So
yeah, I was gonna say, like, it does feel like I think he does end up killing some of these guys, right?
Yeah
maybe indirectly, like they die from the injuries in the hospital, you
something
know?
yeah
like there's no way he could tell, right? The other thing is, in the final fight, there's this part where he gets shot by a shotgun. And he's kind of dazed and he pulls out this green fluid and injects himself with it.
Yeah.
Now, is that Bane venom or is that just like really concentrated Gatorade or something like that?
I thought of it as like adrenaline or something. I figured like,
yeah, that was a weird sort of addition because it was never really teased, you know, like they teased the Batmobile.
Yeah.
They teased some of his weapons. They teased the Batarang. But that was just like out of nowhere. He has this like adrenaline injection.
Yeah. I sort of took it in the time as just being a gadget, you know, part of his like magic bag of tricks around his waist. But, yeah, if they do want to connect that back to a potential Bane appearance, that would be kind of cool. You know, they definitely shied away from any kind of supernatural strength serum stuff.
Yep.
When Tom Hardy played the character. So, hey, why not?
Well,
and it would certainly be better than the version of Bane that we got in the Joel Schumacher film, which, you know, I don't think he even could speak words.
he doesn't. He just goes, Bane.
Yeah. So,
and he's kind of like a henchman for the Poison Ivy.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I mean, this Batman does carry a lot in his suit. I mean, he has a full-on utility belt. He's got all sorts of weird stuff wrapped around his arms and shoulders. So,
yeah.
That stuff must be heavy as hell. But the last thing I want to touch is the final scene where Riddler is sent to Arkham and he meets a special friend. I did not expect this.
Neither did I. Going into it, you know, as soon as the dialogue, like before you even see the character and, you know, the dialogue is very carefully written where it's like he starts talking about clowns and then you're like, oh, okay, your brain lights up a little bit, and then you see that, you know, silhouetted,
yeah, the silhouette
shot
the
of
nose.
Him with the nose, yeah. And that you can almost see some sort of like smile like scars on his face. They keep it deliberately kind of very very shadowy, you know, they don't want to reveal the look yet, which is probably smart on their part because, you know, going into this, they probably didn't know how well it was going to perform at the box office. They didn't have a guarantee that it was going to maybe get a sequel. And Matt Reeves has even said in interviews, you know, now that it's out and people know about this cameo, he said that it's entirely possible that they won't even have much of the Joker in a possible sequel. You know, maybe he'll still be locked up in Arkham.
I think so.
And Barry Keoghan, apparently, who has been revealed to be the unnamed Arkham inmate as he's billed in IMDb, he's apparently cool with that. You know, he was hired just to do this one little shot or this one little sequence, and apparently he's cool with having limited screen time in a sequel too. But I think of everyone that you could have cast, Barry Keoghan is a very smart choice. I mean, he's an up-and-coming actor. He's made a career out of playing creepy little weird guys in other movies. Especially recently, like, you know, he plays a creepy guy in The Green Knight. Did you see Killing of a Sacred Deer?
Yeah, I did.
So, yeah, that was another, like, I've never seen Barry Keoghan be any creepier than in that movie. I'd love him to bring some of that energy to the Joker.
Even in the Eternals, I thought he was kind of creepy.
Yeah, I expected him to actually be more of a villain in Eternals.
Yeah.
And I was kind of disappointed when he wasn't.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the difference between him and Paul Dano is Dano seems more unhinged. Barry Keoghan seems more threatening physically and also in a much more calculated, cold-blooded way. where, like, I think Dano likes to have, or Dano's Riddler, I should say, really likes having other people do the dirty work for him. Whereas Barry Keoghan really looks like the person who'd rather do it himself. Yeah.
And that's in line with, like, the Joker as a character too. You know, he's the type of guy who it's all about the joke, you know, it's all about, you know.
I was just kind of surprised that they introduced him so early, but as I went to watch it with a buddy of mine, but as he pointed out, we had the same thing Batman Begins with the Joker calling card.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where, like, you can't really have a Batman franchise without the Joker. Kind of like you can't have a Superman franchise without Luthor and all that.
Yeah.
And so I get it. And I'm with you. I don't know if Joker's going to be the main villain the second one. I think maybe they should save him for the third one for Batman's Ultimate Showdown.
Yeah.
Where Joker's kind of pulling the strings and you end the second movie on a cliffhanger like they did in Star Wars, and then you kind of complete the arc in the third one. I think it seems like the natural progression.
Yeah, I would like to see them do it that way. You know, they're like I was saying, the rogues gallery for Batman is so deep that you could have anybody be the focus of the second movie and then have the Joker as the final big reveal. You could draw them on video games, even. You could have a little bit of the Arkham Asylum games sprinkled in there where Joker is confined to Arkham. You know, he can't actually leave and cause chaos, but he finds a way to ruin Batman's day anyway.
Yeah, so one of the biggest inspirations for this was The Long Halloween and The Calendar Man.
Yeah.
And it would make a lot of fun. It would be really fun if Batman and the Joker kind of have to, like, work together.
Yeah.
To somehow take down another villain, or he asks the Joker for some help. I think that's a very interesting dynamic to have.
Yes. Yeah.
Very much like Silence of the Lambs. The other thing that they kind of mentioned was that Catwoman kind of takes off on her own at the end of the movie, and she mentions Bloodhaven. So I wonder if this is the first time we'll really see, like, a different Robin and maybe even Nightwing, because we've never seen a Nightwing.
No, I mean, outside of the, I guess, I don't know if they're doing that on any of the DC Universe shows. Is DC Universe even still a thing? I can't remember.
The Titans, the Teen Titans TV show? I think that one had Nightwing.
Oh, okay.
But I'm talking about the live action movie.
Okay, yeah. No, certainly not in any of the live action movies. I feel like you can't have Nightwing for another, like, maybe 20 years of continuity, though, because, you know, we haven't even seen a possible Dick Grayson, you know, as Robin first, unless they decide to just upend the continuity and have, you know, Batman train at Nightwing instead.
Well, I mean, they kind of teased it at the end of his Dark Knight Rise with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, right?
Yeah, yeah. If he was going to become anybody, it would probably be Nightwing.
Yeah. But I mean, Robin as a character kind of sucks. Sorry, guys, but kind of does. I mean, other than the original Robin with Dick Grayson, I mean, Jason Todd had an interesting story, but only because he got, you know, his ass kicked.
Yeah.
And
with a crowbar,
so really brutal. And, like, DC had to walk back some of the storylines in that one because it was just too brutal. And then you had Carrie, the female Robin, and I didn't think she was very
in the Dark Knight Returns.
She didn't feel that interesting.
You had Tim Drake,
who was actually just, like, a whiny little boy, which I thought.
Yeah, he was. Tim Drake was the Robin who successfully figured out who Batman was, and that was why Bruce decided to bring him on as Robin, because he was like, oh, this kid is actually a detective, you know, he can follow clues and understand how to uncover stuff like this.
I love how that's the only requirement.
Yeah. And then finally they, like, in the more recent comics, they had Dick Grayson become Batman while Bruce was, like,
lost in
time. You know, he was a caveman.
Yeah, he took on the mantle for
And then who was it? Bruce's son with Talia al Ghul became Robin. What did they call that character? Damian? Yeah, Damian Wayne.
And it goes off in all sorts of, like, weird directions.
Yeah. Yeah, you cannot fault the Batman universe for not having a lot of canon to draw on when they're adapting these movies.
And doesn't Bruce Wayne have a kid with Lois Lane at one point?
Probably. Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he does.
They've done everything under the sun with those characters by now.
All right. Do you want to go into our final thoughts and the ranking then?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, as you can tell, I get from both of us, we're both giving this a strong recommendation. I'm coming in at 4.5 out of 5 on it. I feel very good about that. I almost wanted to give it a 5. Where are you sitting with it?
I came at a solid 4.5.
Okay, cool. So we're matched.
One of the rare times, but I was you sounded really like kind of hesitant before we did this pod, and I was like, I can't wait to tell him how.
Yeah.
It's definitely better than a 4.
Oh yeah.
I hesitate to give it a 5 because of its runtime.
Yeah.
And at times it did seem a little convoluted.
Yeah, that's fair. I think maybe that might have been working in the background to kind of influence my score too. But if I had to rank them, like I know you gave us a little bit of homework before we did this, and
yes. It
was to create a list of the 10 Batman appearances, live action appearances since Tim Burton's original one in 1989.
Do you want to count down from it? Start from 10. I'll just match you as we go along, like we do for our top 10 films.
Okay, so number 10, you're not gonna be surprised by this: Batman v Superman. I don't, for all of the love that one scene where he's like ripping through the bad guys, for all the love that gets, I really don't like that movie at all.
I think you and I have 10 and 9 flipped. So in 10 I have Batman and Robin, and 9 I have
correct
Batman and Superman.
yeah so
okay,
then number 8, Zack Snyder's Justice League. I know this is going to be higher on your list, but...
It is, but it's not as high as you think, I think.
Okay.
Like, the problem with ranking these films is that, like, each Batman has a very good entry, but they're all totally different.
Yeah.
And it's very subjective. So it really depends on if you like a more comic book, fantasy-style Batman, if you want a realistic Batman, if you want, like, quote-unquote gritty Batman. So at number 8, I have Batman Forever.
Oh, okay. Yep. I have Batman Forever at 7.
Okay. All right. So number 7 for me, you're probably going to disagree with this, but I have The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay.
Because like, I think you already know kind of like my thoughts about that film. Like, I just didn't enjoy it as much as other people, I think. And over time, I've grown less fond of it for various reasons.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I was very positive on it when it first came out because I like Christopher Nolan that much. And but yeah, it's fallen a little bit for me too.
Actually, on that note, has your regard for Christopher Nolan kind of fallen off a little bit?
No, I think it's about about even with Matt Reeves right now.
Okay.
So, and we'll see.
But not even after Tenet?
No. Because I really like Tenet.
Okay.
But I'm in this headspace where I'm like, you know, they're just giving different visions of Batman. And I like that. And plus, like, we haven't seen everything that Matt Reeves has planned for this character either.
Sure.
So it's hard to compare. But so then sticking with the rankings down to number 6, I have the original Batman from 89.
Ooh, so low.
Yeah.
But I don't disagree. So for number 6, I have Justice League.
Okay.
And I think this feels appropriate. And we're obviously talking about the Snyder Cut. It's not really a Batman vehicle.
No.
But if we're talking about like overly long superhero slogs, I prefer Justice League over The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay.
I just think it's visually and story-wise more interesting than Dark Knight Rises.
Certain days of the week, I might agree with you, but not today.
Okay, number 5?
Number 5, Batman Returns.
Oh, wow. Okay, number 5, I have Tim Burton's original Batman.
Number 4, Dark Knight Rises.
Interesting. Number 4, I have Batman Begins.
Okay, yeah. So I have Batman Begins at 3.
So if you have... Oh, this is interesting. Okay, for number 3, I have The Batman, this one.
Okay. So then for 2, The Batman.
Okay, all right. For 2, I have The Dark Knight.
Yeah, so then you know where this is going. So yeah. I'm gonna put The Dark Knight at number 1.
And I have Batman Returns as number 1.
Okay.
This was really hard, though. I just appreciated Batman Returns for how committed it is to Tim Burton's vision.
Yeah.
And I loved like the horror aspect of it. And I just think it's a very entertaining film, which is honestly at the end of the day, what you want in a Batman.
Yeah. I mean, I still like, if you had to get me to watch anything from the 90s era of Batman today, I would always go to Batman Returns before any of the others. I think it's an example of like a filmmaker figuring out the character more so on the second time round than on the first, because there's things about like Jack Nicholson's Joker is a classic because he was the first guy to like do him in a big live action performance like that, big money behind it.
But it was almost too much Jack Nicholson, right?
It was.
That was always,
you know,
the criticism. Yeah.
And they do things with the origin of the character and the stuff that I've never really liked, you know, having him be the guy who kills the Waynes and stuff like that, just it didn't sit well with me. simplified it a little bit too much, like you were saying earlier. So, yeah, I can't go super high for that reason.
Yeah, I appreciated how creepy Danny DeVito was as the Penguin. I mean, that was a straight up horror show.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the part where he bites off the guy's nose.
Yeah.
I mean, blood just like squirts everywhere. I'm like, yeah, okay, I can see why McDonald's decided not to do Happy Meal toys for this movie. And I also enjoyed Michelle Pfeiffer because, wow, she really committed like to her role.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think even to this day, I know Zoe Kravitz did a really good job, but I think Michelle Pfeiffer is still my Catwoman of choice.
Mm, that's fair.
Maybe I just really like deranged characters because Michael Keaton is a deranged Batman.
Yeah. And we get to potentially see him again in this Flashpoint movie they're working on.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, good point. But to finish off this episode, Robert Pattinson as Batman, how do you feel about him relative to all the other ones? I mean, let's face it. George Clooney is by far the worst.
Yeah, he's the worst. I feel like, you know, if he had been given more to work with on a script level, maybe he could have made an okay try at it.
I feel like he was just a bad choice.
Yeah, he just doesn't look comfortable as the character.
Yeah,
he looks like he's like reflexively kind of like trying to make fun of himself. Yeah. To like head people off before they can make fun of him.
He's the only actor I think that I can think of that did not like playing Batman and obviously had no regard for that character before he took on that role.
He spent the last 10 or so years, you know, on red carpets also like bringing it up and saying things like, oh, I'm never going to show Amal this movie, referring to his wife, because I don't want her like respect for me to fall at all. And I'm like,
but it like, again, it's on him. It's not the source material, because you can make Batman so interesting. Yeah. He just chose not to.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, Schumacher's had his hand in it as well. And it's so, yeah, there's a reason why people rank it pretty low on most rankings.
Yeah, I rank it the lowest. Yeah. So, I mean, mostly for that, it's just it was the wrong Batman.
Yeah.
But then we're left with Val Kilmer, Michael Keaton, Christian Bale, and Robert Pattinson.
I kind of like Pattinson the most right now.
No bias?
Maybe it's the bias of like being the most recent one. Yeah, that's fair. But I don't know. Like for a while, Christian Bale was my Batman. Like I really liked what he was doing with it. But I see what people mean when they say that he's better as Batman than he is as Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Because you do get more of the playboy kind of quality of Bruce Wayne in Bale's performance.
Because he's the most good looking out of all of them.
Yeah, yeah. And he has less to work with on an emotional level as Bruce Wayne. And his goodbye to the life of Batman at the end of Dark Knight Rises is kind of a whimper, you know, he doesn't.
Yeah.
I've felt very narratively unfulfilled with what they did there, and I feel like
yep.
What Pattinson gets a lot of time here to chew on where he came from and what his motivations are. And he never has to be in the suit to do any of that. And I feel like that's a screenplay thing. Like they wrote that material with that in mind, but he also, as an actor, he's bringing a lot to it too.
Yeah. So they wrote the two leads, Catwoman and him, with Pattinson and Kravitz in mind. So it obviously shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always thought Val Kilmer was underappreciated. I didn't think he was a great Batman, but he's a pretty good tortured Bruce Wayne as well.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Keaton's a personal favorite because I love all his work, but he's a little too unhinged as well. So I don't know. I really enjoyed Robert Pattinson. I like his character, or I like the take on his character, at least. He's a little mopey sometimes, and he moves a little slow for my liking. Like I said, that's probably why it's 3 hours, because it takes him like an hour to walk across the damn room.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe he'll, him and Alfred will come up with some super futuristic bat suit materials, and he'll be able to, like, you know how Batman from Batman Begins was like big and rubbery, and then he slimmed down and got very athletic in Dark Knight. I feel like maybe they'll do something like that with the next Robert Pattinson film, and you know, we'll get the ultimate bat suit for him, and he'll be zipping around. we'll lose half an hour of runtime like that.
But anyway, I think that does it for this episode.
Yes, go see The Batman if you have not already. It is very worth it.
I'm going to go see it again sometime soon.
Very excited for this, for people in the mainstream to finally see what I've been saying about Robert Pattinson for a number of years now.
That's what I meant about your bias. You were on the Pattinson train a long time ago.
Yeah.
So That does it for this episode. My name is Jason Chen in Vancouver.
And my name is Robert Snow in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and talk to you next time.
The Extra Buttery Podcast is written, recorded, and produced by Jason Chen and Robert Snow. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. And remember, popcorn is always better with extra butter.